Our debate, we have two fine gentlemen that will be debating. Our Congressman Bill Luther, representing the 6th District. And one thing I want to say about Bill is that he sits on the vital, important Commerce Committee. And the Commerce Committee has oversight over issues like trade and health care, and it's probably the most important committee in the entire House of Representatives. And Bill Luther sits on that committee, and so it's a very valuable input that we get from on the Commerce Committee from our local representative. Bill Luther is running for his third term in Congress. He's running for his fourth term in Congress, and he's been recognized as someone that exercises a great deal of fiscal discipline by groups such as the Concord Coalition. And we're really pleased to have Bill on coming here today, taking time. Congress is still in session. His time is very valuable, and to spend time with us, we really appreciate it. Thank you, Bill. And along with Bill, we have John Klein, and John Klein has a really distinguished career. John is a Marine, or ex-Marine, and he served in 25 years of active duty in the Marine Corps. John also served under two presidents. He was a military aide for both presidents Carter and Reagan. And I think one other important factor is that John Klein is also a member of the Metro North Chamber of Commerce and has come all the way from from Lakeville, where his home is, to sit on our government affairs committees many times. So both of these gentlemen, we're really pleased to have them. They're both very, very good people, and we are thrilled for this debate. And so I'm going to turn the microphone over to Bill Ekstrom. Bill?
Thank you very much, Tom. I'm going to use this. If this gets in the way, I can perhaps, I don't know if we need to tone this down a bit or not. I'm pleased to be here. I do chair the Governmental Affairs Committee for the Chamber, and I think maybe this is too much feedback. So I'll speak on this microphone, and we'll make do. I was hoping to have that third mic because both of the candidates will be speaking on the other mics. We do welcome both Representative Luther and John Klein to this debate. This is one of the most hotly contested races in the country this year. A lot of interest in it. And we welcome both candidates here the opportunity to ask them questions, particularly on tax issues, small business issues, and related issues that would be, of course, of interest to the chamber membership here. We had occasion to do a little coin flipping before the program today, and so Representative Luther will be speaking first, I believe. Oh, I'm sorry. There we go. My mistake. John Klein will be speaking first, and Representative Luther will be speaking second in each of both the opening statements and the closing statements today. And each candidate will be given the opportunity to have 2 minutes for their opening remarks. After that, there will be two questions posed by Brian Trowbridge, past president of our chamber, and who has questions ready for the candidates. Following that, individual people here in the audience will have a chance to pose questions. Each of the questions we'll be asking the candidates to spend no more than a minute answering, and we'll try to adhere to that schedule. And the other candidate will have a 1 minute rebuttal opportunity. When we get done with those questions and answers, each candidate will have 2 minutes at the end of the program to give any closing remarks they choose to give. So with that, I would ask John Klein to come up and give your opening remarks.
Well, thank you very much, Bill, and thank you, Tom Snell. the director here of the Metro North Chamber of Commerce. As usual, you've done an extraordinary job. But mostly thank all of you, fellow chamber members and guests, for coming out on this absolutely glorious day. This is why we live in Minnesota, isn't it? It's an absolutely beautiful day. I'm very gratified that your interest in this election this year. You know, there are two views of the role of government in keeping America the greatest country in the world and of ensuring that our children and grandchildren share in the American dream that has been such an important part of my life and our lives. One view, and I think you'll see largely shared by my opponent, is a large role for the federal government. More regulation, more litigation, higher taxes. The other view, my view, puts faith in free enterprise, stresses more local government, fewer regulations, less litigation, lower taxes. I'm looking forward to the discussion today. I think you'll see those differences come clear. I'm looking forward to your questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Luther?
Well, good afternoon to all of you. Nice to see all of you. Thanks to the chamber for the outstanding job, and it's nice to see John and his wife, Vicki, in the audience. Great to see you, Vicki. It's a real honor for me to serve all of you in the United States Congress. I think all of you know that in my short time there, which it seems sometimes like a long time, but it's been 6 years now, I've tried to do the absolute best job that I could for you. I have tried to run a first-class office, and I've tried to avoid the partisanship in Washington in order to get the job done for all of you. We obviously are in a period now of great economic strength in our country, but there's still many things that need to be done in order to spread that prosperity out to families and businesses around the country. We need to fix Medicare, Social Security. We need to add a prescription drug benefit to Medicare in order to deal with that serious problem for our senior citizens. We need common sense tax relief that is targeted to help people most in need today, things like deductions for college tuition and other things that we can do in Washington with the good budget in the shape that it's in today. We need to guarantee that our public schools are safe and have the highest expectations for our students. We need to trim wasteful government spending. I think many of you are aware of the fiscal responsibility ratings that I have received. Recently, Taxpayers for Common Sense gave me the rating of the number one person out of 435 members of the U.S. House of Representatives for my efforts to cut unnecessary government spending. We need to make sure that we continue to balance our budget and start paying down the national debt, because the best thing we can do to continue prosperity in this country and the best tax cut we can give everyone is to keep that economy going, keep those interest rates down, and never go back into the situation we faced in this country when I first went to Washington. It's a critical time in our nation's history. There are different paths that we can choose. I think we should choose the path that applies the kind of values and common sense that many of us learned growing up right here in Minnesota, and that is to make sure that the prosperity we're enjoying in this country does not just get limited to a few, but that that prosperity is in fact shared by everyone. That's my vision of America, and I hope your vision too. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now we have questions to be posed by Brian Trowbridge. Again, Brian is a former chamber president, and he has some questions that have been discussed with Tom and through our chamber office and prepared to ask our candidates. And Brian and audience, we're going to start by just reversing the order with each question in terms of what candidates will apply. So Representative Luther will respond first to this one. Mr. Klein will respond second, and then we'll flip it for the next question.
Chamber of made up predominantly of small businesses. This first question is wrong with us, and I am going to ask two questions. I ask that you answer the first, and I'll get up to the second one after. The first question is, with the cost of health insurance increasing by double-digit rates for small business, what role does the federal government have in reducing this?
It's a great question. It's one that we've dealt with for a number of years. Obviously, keeping the good economy going is helpful to the whole equation. But in addition to that, the whole deductibility of health insurance, which is something we've worked on that I consistently stood with you on in terms of the ability to deduct the full cost of health insurance for small businesses, is something I have supported and will continue to support. Thank you.
Probably one of your largest operating expenses these days. I know that the costs for many of you have jumped enormously. I think that Mr. Luther is absolutely correct in talking about the deductibility of insurance for small businesses, a very important part of the role. We need to make sure that when we look at health care overall in the United States, and we do have to look at that, not just for small businesses, but for large and for Medicare as well, that we get the patient actively involved in the process. We as patients should have as much choice as possible in choosing who provides our insurance and who provides our health care. The more we're actively involved and the more we have a role in that, the better health care will be. Medical savings accounts, deductibility of insurance for small businesses are steps in that direction.
Thank you for your response. Second question. The United States is ranked 24, tied with Portugal, for high school students graduating with their understanding of math and science. What role, if any, does the federal government have in correcting this situation? Mr. Klein, if you could first.
Yes, well, that's an indication of an overall problem that we have with education. I mean, I suppose you could say that the federal government has a role in offering some suggestions on ways to teach math and science or any subject. There is actually an office that sits up there in the vast bureaucracy called the Education Research and Improvement Office, which could probably stand to be reformed and given some independence and look around the country and around the world at teaching methods. But that's a band-aid. Fundamentally, we need to return control of education to the parents and teachers here in Minnesota. We need to let teachers teach, let them impose and restore, in many cases, discipline in the classroom. We need to make decisions here in Minnesota on how best to educate our kids and reduce, and I say reduce, not eliminate, reduce the role of the federal government in management decisions and in telling us how to educate our kids.
Again, a terrific question. Having parents and local school boards deciding education, I think everyone would agree on that. But there is a role for the United States government to provide national leadership in the area of education. We need the same commitment to educating our people that we had to put a person on the moon, that we had to win a world war. That's the commitment we need in this country, and that means that the federal government needs to partner with states and local units of government in order to make sure that we get those reduced class sizes, that we have the highest expectations, that we have accountability, that we have new innovative approaches like charter schools, things that I've supported. So we have a very strong leadership role that can be provided, and I believe that we need to do that if we are going to win the economic war of the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and now we'll try to field some questions from the floor and again have responses from both candidates. Understand that we'll go for a while here and we're going to try to honor a time schedule, so if we get too close to the end, I'm going to make a decision at some point to stop the questioning and allow closing remarks. I saw our hand right over here. Harold.
Projects, schools, roads, and other projects. Minimum wages, and 15,000 small businesses in Anoka County.
Harold, you said a lot, and I didn't get all that on mic, so I'll try to repeat it, but the question was whether you believe in the free enterprise system or whether you believe in price controls, and you specifically referred to prevailing wage, you referred to minimum wage, and you referred to the cost of prescription drugs, and then asked at the end of your question whether there ought to be a profit set for the businesses in Anoka County. So, Mr. Luther, sure. Would you please start with
that? I'll try to do that. Clearly, I think everyone here would agree on the free enterprise system. The question is when the free enterprise system doesn't work. And there are instances where it doesn't work and needs some assistance from some government guidance. A good example of that is in minimum wage, the people who are serving us here today. These people deserve to have a fair wage, not the kind of wage that many places they would be paid if there wasn't a minimum wage in this country. In the area of mergers and acquisitions, there's a role for government, or we might end up with one airline, as some are suggesting could occur. Prescription drugs, the current pricing structure is totally wrong. The most hard-pressed people in society are paying the highest prices. That's wrong, and government has to step in and make sure that pricing system is fair. So the free enterprise system, I think we can all support, but there is a role for government to protect and make the system fair for the public in a number of instances. Thank you.
Free enterprise works. We're the greatest country in the world because of capitalism and free enterprise. And we need to ensure that that flourishes. The government should not impose price controls. That's never worked. And it doesn't make any difference whether it was imposed by a Republican president or someone else. Price controls don't work. Minimum wage is largely irrelevant in this day and age. There's probably nobody in Minnesota, very few people in Minnesota working for minimum wage. Wages ought to be determined by the market. Now, prescription drugs is a very interesting issue and probably another question, and I may not have time to get into that. Right now in the United States, the American people are largely subsidizing the rest of the world in the price of prescription drugs. There is an imbalance there. But imposing price controls is not the answer. In the long term, those price discrepancies between the United States and the rest of the world will probably be worked out with the market and with trade negotiations. In the near term, there are some suggestions to open up trade and allow us to import or re-import drugs from Canada, say. I think that's an approach that we should take for the near term, but it's not a long-term solution.
Questions, and I'll call on people as I happen to see them, and I saw your hand first, sir.
Clearly, if Medicare was set up today, there would be a prescription drug benefit to Medicare. It wouldn't be something that would be being paid by other people. It would be built into the basic charges associated with Medicare. The proposal, and the reason that didn't occur is, of course, prescription drugs was not a large component of health care costs at the time that Medicare was set up. Today, it is. So the proposal in Washington that I support is one that allows people to voluntarily join a prescription drug benefit through Medicare, because that will effectively deal in part with this pricing problem that's going on, where the most hard-pressed people in our country are basically paying for the profits and R&D of the drug companies, while people in other countries and people on plans are actually getting the reduced rates. So yes, I do strongly support a prescription drug benefit for Medicare, a voluntary one.
We have had a practice in this country for a long time of providing a safety net. And I think that most of us would agree that it's unconscionable here for someone to be a senior citizen to actually be making a devastating choice between food on the table and important medicine, prescription drug. We will almost certainly have to provide some prescription drug coverage for some people. I don't think it's appropriate for us to provide prescription drug coverage under Medicare for the wealthiest people in this country. I guess we don't need to mention it. Let's pick a real big one. Bill Gates probably doesn't need it into Medicare. So I'm sure that as we look at Medicare, we will provide some safety net, some coverage for prescription medicine. But the real issue is fixing Medicare. Medicare itself is in peril as a program. And when we look at reforming Medicare, and we had a chance, there was an opportunity, there was a bipartisan commission that was headed by a Democrat senator from Louisiana named Breaux, came out with some pretty good recommendations. It was an important step towards fixing Medicare so that it's there not just for the senior citizens in the room, but for those of us, Mr. Luther and myself, getting closer, to fix Medicare for the long term. If we don't do that, it'll break. And I'm confident that in fixing that, there will be some coverage for prescription drugs. There's a great imbalance in Medicare right now, as you know. If you live in, well, say, Miami, Florida, you have a great deal of prescription drug coverage. If you live in Minnesota, you don't have it. So that's just part of what needs to be done to fix Medicare.
Thank you. Other questions? Yes, sir.
As a follow-up to your education answer earlier, we can look at the superposition of federal block grants for education. And you kind of touched on this earlier about the role of the federal government in local districts. But kind of in light of that, how does the federal government ensure that there are high quality teachers in the district?
Okay, we'll start with Mr. Klein.
I do believe in block grants. That's the surest way to make sure that the parents and teachers here in Minnesota are making the decisions. In the Department of Education right now in Washington has over 230 separate programs. Over 160 of them require grants that each school district and state has to apply for. Some really, really bizarre things when you look at the role that the federal government has taken in education today. I mentioned that the 200 plus programs of the Department of Education, over 700 programs involving education of all sorts administered by 39 agencies in the federal government. We're the only modern, if you will, industrialized country in the world that has over half of its employees in the education system involved in administration. There are many inefficiencies and problems. 6 or 7% of the education dollar comes from Washington. Arguably over half of the paperwork comes from Washington. So using block grants and letting the educators here get back to the business of educating makes a great deal of sense to me. The more control that we have for parents and teachers here in Minnesota, the more innovation we'll get, the better our kids will be in school.
Yeah, I support greater flexibility for the dollars because I find in many instances Minnesota is ahead of where other states are, and if we can get more flexibility, it means that we can apply those same dollars. In education, we need a strong Department of Education in Washington, but a reformed department, a department that does provide tests for local school districts, that does provide standards that are voluntary with local parents and local school districts, because most parents I talk to, they want to know how their kids are doing. They don't want to get some hype from somebody telling them that their kids are above average, like we all are in Minnesota, of course. They want to know exactly how they're doing because they know their kids are going to be out competing in the economy of tomorrow. And that's why there is a strong role for testing, for standards, for accountability, for reduced class sizes, for character education in schools. And it's also one of the reasons that I have supported innovative approaches like the charter schools. I believe that allows us to see innovative new ways to deliver learning. But it's very important that we have a strong national commitment because education is the issue of the future. It's going to define us and our people in the future.
Okay, I saw a hand over here. Yes, sir.
Thank you. My question is in regards to oil prices. The last 8 to 10 years or so, the Trump administration has virtually zero on their national energy policy. And even the president responded
question has to do with energy policy and the use of the oil reserves. And let's start with Congressman Luther.
Sure. Yes. I think under the circumstances we are in, it was an appropriate thing to do. And apparently there are some positive results as a result of what occurred in terms of that particular decision. But long term, we need an energy policy, but this is not a partisan issue. We should be focusing on renewables, energy conservation. There's all kinds of things that come into this equation, and there has been no action by this particular Congress getting any activity on those key issues that are involved in developing an energy policy. So this certainly is not the kind of issue that one would say it's the Clinton administration or someone else. There needs to be bipartisan work in order to have an energy policy, because we've had cheap energy for a long time and we're now facing a real challenge to the future. And so if you look at my record, you'll find that I've consistently voted for efforts in energy conservation, renewables, and attempting to do what I can to develop a long-term energy policy for this country.
I did not agree with the president's move to release 30 million barrels of oil. That oil reserve was put in place for national security reasons, to be used in the event of a disruption of supply. It was never intended to be used to have anything to do with manipulating the price of oil in the markets. That's what the markets are for. I agree wholeheartedly that we haven't had an energy policy, certainly not for the last, say, 7.5 years, and not to make this partisan, of course, but we have not. In fact, I think that this Department of Energy has been completely out of step, has not stepped up to address those long-term issues of both supply and demand. They've been distracted by some other issues. We do need a national energy policy that is largely the duty of the executive branch. Certainly the Congress plays a role in enacting legislation and providing oversight, but that's an executive branch role.
Yes, the hand back there. Question on gun control and compared to the NRA.
We have arguably a problem with firearms violence in this country, and have had for some time. And we have been trying for a number of years, since 1968, to do something about that firearms violence with the thing that you're calling gun control. And it involves identifying different kinds of hardware, different sorts of guns, different kinds of bullets, different ways to buy them, who can buy them, waiting periods, and all sorts of things. And I would argue that we still have a problem with firearms violence. What we haven't done is enforce the law. We have multiple laws on the book now, and I think we ought to give that a try. I will give you an example. I was looking the other day, because this is an issue of some interest to me, as it is to you. We've had over 70,000 attempts by felons to purchase firearms, and that's against the law. But we've had only 3 convictions, less than 1 in 1,000 prosecutions. So we need to enforce the laws. Now, how does that differ from the NRA position? I believe that, in fact, that is the NRA position. They've stepped up to the plate, recognized that we have gun control laws on the books, and we need to enforce them.
The NRA has incredible clout, political clout in this country, and there are many people who will not differ from the NRA because of the power and clout they have. I'm a sportsman, hunted all my life, but the people I hunt with don't use automatic assault weapons, for example. They don't use them. Those things are to kill kids on our streets. So there are a number of instances where I will differ from the NRA. Those instances would be banning assault weapons, for example. Closing the gun show loophole. Trigger locks on handguns. And I will analyze any proposal that comes before me and decide what is the best for the families of this district. And you can't effectively represent the families of this district unless you have that independence from the NRA. Thank you.
I saw a couple of hands over here. Yes, you're the first that I saw.
But what would you specifically do if you think some of the Medicare disparity, and do you support an infant's Bill of Rights?
Question has to do with Medicare and supporting a patient's Bill of Rights. And yes, go ahead.
Okay, on the last point first, I do support the bipartisan Patient's Bill of Rights that is currently in the conference committee being held up again by powerful interests in Washington. On the Medicare disparity, that's the issue that was referred to earlier, where there's the disparity between what you get in Minnesota versus what you get in Dade County, Florida, or whatever. As was mentioned by Tom, it took me 4 years to get on the Commerce Committee. I'm now on that Commerce Committee in a position to do something on that issue. Last year, we fixed that problem, the $50 million problem for Minnesota hospitals. We got that behind us. This year, just this week, Heather Wilson of New Mexico and I offered the amendment in the Commerce Committee, and it was successful in starting to close that disparity. We will shorten the gap by about 20% this year if we can now get this pushed through the Congress, and then what we can do is come back in succeeding years, in the next few years, to continue to shorten that gap to the point where we have complete equity for the senior citizens in Minnesota. So again, it's an opportunity that I have serving on this committee to do that, and I intend to fight that fight until we get that unfairness, that blatant unfairness, taken care of. Thank you.
It is a blatant unfairness. I mentioned it earlier. It just seems unconscionable to me that because you live in Florida, that you get your prescription drugs, your eyeglasses covered, you get much more reimbursement from Medicare than you do if you live in Minnesota. And just a little background here, that goes way back to about 1982 when these standards were first established. It was set up that way because we in Minnesota were doing such a darn good job here in providing medical care at a reasonable cost. And now we're paying the price for that. So we have to work on that. But it's only one piece of the problem, if you will, with Medicare. We need to take a big look at Medicare and make sure that it's there for our kids and our grandkids. We need to do something again, like the Breaux Commission, which unfortunately President Clinton just threw out, even though it was a bipartisan commission. We need to go to that approach and fix Medicare for the long term, or it will fail. It will fail. A patient's Bill of Rights. I would support a patient's Bill of Rights. I do not support the patient's Bill of Rights that called for opening up litigation and allowing employers to be sued. I think that will be devastating to the people in this room and to important businesses in this district that employ thousands of people. 3M, Northwest Airlines, Medtronic, that's not a good bill.
Saw a hand over here and then we'll get back over here. Yes, sir.
As a younger worker, I'm very concerned with all these paid and Social Security. And one of the reasons that I'm supporting G.W. Bush is that he wanted to look at a proactive partial privatization plan for Social Security. And like him, I believe that I can get a better return on my investment than the government can. And I was wondering about your views on Social Security, specifically as a younger worker.
Question about Social Security and the partial privatization of it and its effect on younger workers. Mr. Klein.
We will inevitably move to a system that allows you, Commissioner, and others, younger workers, to invest a part of their Social Security taxes into accounts that they own and control. We're going to do that. The alternatives are unthinkable. The current system, while it has served my mother well, will not be able to serve my children and grandchildren. It won't be there. Demographics and basic math say that's impossible. We're going to get to the point around 2030 where there are two workers for every retiree. There are no choices that can make that work unless you reduce benefits or raise taxes. Taxes are already at a too high level. We're going to move to a system like that. If you just tried to keep the Social Security Trust Fund in a big pile of money, you have to ask, who's in charge of that? Bureaucrats, are they going to invest it? Is government going to invest it and take care of it? Or are you going to do that and you're going to own it? If you own it, you'll get a better rate of return. You'll be able to leave it to your kids. You'll have a sound retirement system.
We don't need to tinker with the Social Security system in that respect. What we need to do is make sure we're not using Social Security monies to fund other things. That's the key position that I have taken. And the reason that we don't need to tinker with it in the respect you're talking about is the fact, what are we going to do when there are bad investments, if the money is invested and the investments don't turn out right? The government is going to have to come in anyway. We need to encourage more savings in this country. This country is a consumption country, so we should have incentives built in to encourage additional savings over and above the Social Security system so that people can have individual retirement accounts where they have control and they do investments. We can have that in addition, and it'll be good for the economy, it'll be good for our country.
We have time for two more questions, and I see the two hands here. Yes, ma'am.
We can be quick on this one, I think. Yes, that's, you've stated that you've stated it accurately. The local companies have come to our Commerce Committee trying to get a change in that law, and I do not support changing that and giving them further monopolistic opportunities. Quite frankly, is what they are. The whole purpose of this deregulation was to allow true competition in this country, competition to flourish. And so I do not support, have not supported that effort for one company to come in and try to continually monopolize that service. So thank you. It's a great and a very timely question. The pressure is enormous in Washington for people to go on that bill and to do that. And I have withstood that pressure and intend to continue to do so.
You got me. I've never read H.R. 2420. I was amazed that I would have had to read that question too. The obvious answer is that we do want to encourage competition. That is why we started to, why we broke up Ma Bell, why we have the regional Bell operating companies in the first place, was to encourage competition. We need that to have the opportunity to make choices. What the details of the bill are, I don't have a clue.
One final question. Yes, sir. About flat tax proposal and meaningful tax reform. Mr. Klein.
If we could get a flat tax tomorrow, I would take it. If we could get a national sales tax tomorrow, I would take it. The current tax code is just absolutely atrocious. And the stories are endless about its length and weight and complexity. I'm a little bit embarrassed to say that between Vicki and I, we have about four college degrees and we hire somebody to do our taxes. There's something wrong with this system. So we need to eliminate the current tax code and replace it with something that's simple and fair. And it can be a flat tax or it can be a sales tax. It can be a flatter tax. The current system is awful. Let me just talk about something else here because we're down to the last question and talk about taxes in general.
We're probably not going to move to a system like that this term or next. You ask about the probability of that. I would like to see us make directions. That's a bipartisan effort. We've got the Democrats and Republicans supporting different versions of those things. What we have had the opportunity to do is lower some taxes. We've had the opportunity to eliminate the marriage penalty, and we didn't do it. We voted for it, bipartisan effort. 48 or 50 or 46 or some number like that of Democrats joined with Republicans to eliminate the marriage penalty. We didn't do it. We had a chance to eliminate the estate tax, the death tax that ought to be of some importance to the small business owners in this room. We didn't do it. We need to lower the tax burden on the people here in Minnesota.
You won't get much disagreement in lowering the tax burden. The question is how you do it. And you have to look at the details of the bills. You can't just say, I'm for this, I'm for that, I'm for all these things until you see the details. Some of the things those proposals will do is not give you a home interest deduction, not give you a local tax deduction. There's a lot of other things they won't do. Some of those flat tax proposals will tax the people on wages that are waiting on our tables here, but will not tax people on their investment income. So you have to look at the details. Same way as the same thing concerning this marriage tax proposal. I have voted to eliminate the marriage penalty. I have voted to do that, but not a bill that gives half of the benefits to people who don't even have a marriage penalty. That's the problem with the bill that comes up in Congress. I voted to give a couple a $4 million tax exemption before you would pay an estate tax. That makes sense. But to repeal the entire thing for Bill Gates and other people like that does not make sense when we have other national priorities, prescription drugs, education, eliminating the tax on college tuition, the other kinds of things that we need to do. So the important thing for a member of Congress is to read the details of legislation and know how it's going to impact the people of the district.
Thank you very much to all of you who have asked questions, and I appreciate your cooperation as well as the cooperation of both of the candidates here. And now it is time for closing remarks. Mr. Klein.
Well, thank you again for joining us today. I know it's a sacrifice. Are most of you ready to jump back to work? I can see that now. Excellent lunch, maybe not as big a sacrifice as I thought. As I projected, there are differences between Mr. Luther and myself on the role of government, on the importance of tax relief, on the importance of regulatory reform. Clear differences. I want to talk about this taxes thing again for just a minute. We lost the opportunity for rebuttal, maybe because it didn't occur to me that we were losing that earlier. So I'd like to go back to what Bill just said about looking at the details. Every single bill that comes up before Congress does have details. And there's always some reason why you can't support a bill. You can find something in there. They're pages and pages and pages long. But if we look at the marriage penalty, that was an opportunity with more than 80,000 married couples in this district, that was an opportunity to eliminate a penalty that would have given back to most of those families an average of about $1,400 a year. And would have returned to working families, working couples in America over a 10-year period, about $180 billion that they're much better prepared to spend than the federal government. That's the difference, in my view, about who's best qualified to spend the money. I believe in the people of Minnesota. I believe in the American people. I believe in free enterprise. I believe we're better suited here in Minnesota to make decisions on how to spend our money, how to educate our kids, how to run our businesses. I believe in local control, fewer regulations, less litigation, and lower taxes. And if you share that view with me, I'd very much like your vote in November. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Thanks to all of you for being here. It's great to see all of you, and it's nice to see you, John and Vicki. I'll tell you this, it's been a great honor representing you, and I would like that opportunity to continue representing you. And I'll tell you, the way I approach this job is I apply the values and common sense that I learned growing up on a dairy farm out in western Minnesota. And I know you all have your background as well. That's what I apply. And I'll tell you, when a tax bill comes along and gives 80% of the benefits to the top 20% of the people in this country, I know something's wrong. That's not the way I learned as a young person on that farm. My role in Washington has been to look out for the little person. I have taken on every big interest group you can imagine, the NRA, the tobacco lobby, the pharmaceutical industry, to the point where they would stick those ads on TV in this state. And the list goes on and on, HMOs, insurance industry, whatever it is, because you need someone on your side paying attention to the details of the legislation and fighting for you. If you elect me this fall, I intend to continue that fight, taking on whatever interest in order to do what is in the interest of the people and the families of this district. Thank you.
Thank you again to both of you, and I would appreciate a hand for both candidates for their participation today.
Thank you.